What Do You Care What Other People Think? Further Adventures of a Curious Character by Richard P. Feynman, as told to Ralph Layton. Preface. Because of the appearance of "Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman," a few things need to be explained here. First, although the central character in this book is the same as before, the adventures of a curious character here are different. Some are light and some tragic, but most of the time Mr. Feynman is surely not joking, although it's often hard to tell. Second, the stories in this book fit together more loosely than those in "Surely You're Joking," where they were arranged chronologically to give a semblance of order. That resulted in some readers getting the mistaken idea that SYJ is an autobiography. My motivation is simple. Ever since hearing my first Feynman stories, I have had the powerful desire to share them with others. Finally, most of these stories were not told at drumming sessions as before. I will elaborate on this in the brief outline that follows. Part 1, A Curious Character, begins by describing the influence of those who most shaped Feynman's personality: his father, Mel, and his first love, Arlene. The first story was adapted from The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, a BBC program produced by Christopher Sykes. The story of Arlene, from which the title of this book was taken, was painful for Feynman to recount. It was assembled over the past 10 years out of pieces from 6 different stories. When it was finally complete, Feynman was especially fond of this story and happy to share it with others. The other Feynman stories in Part 1, although generally lighter in tone, are included here because there won't be a second volume of SYJ. Feynman was particularly proud of It's As Simple As 1, 2, 3, which he occasionally thought of writing up as a psychology paper. The letters in the last chapter of Part 1 have been provided courtesy of Gwyneth Feynman, Freeman Dyson, and Henry Beta. Part 2, Mr. Feynman Goes to Washington, is, unfortunately, Feynman's last big adventure. The story is particularly long because its content is still timely. Shorter versions have appeared in Engineering and Science and Physics Today. It was not published sooner because Feynman underwent his 3rd and 4th major surgeries, plus radiation, hyperthermia, and other treatments since serving on the Rogers Commission. Feynman's decade-long battle against cancer ended on February 15, 1988, 2 weeks after he taught his last class at Caltech. I decided to include one of his most eloquent and inspirational speeches, The Value of Science, as an epilogue. Ralph Layton, March 1988. What Do You Care What Other People Think? Part 1. A Curious Character. The Making of a Scientist. I have a friend who's an artist, and he sometimes takes a view which I don't agree with. He'll hold up a flower and say, "Look how beautiful it is," and I'll agree. But then he'll say, "I, as an artist, can see how beautiful a flower is, but you, as a scientist, take it all apart and it becomes dull." I think he's kind of nutty. First of all, the beauty that he sees is available to other people, and to me too, I believe. Although I might not be quite as refined aesthetically as he is, I can appreciate the beauty of a flower. But at the same time, I see much more in the flower than he sees. I can imagine the cells inside, which also have a beauty. There is beauty not just at the dimension of 1 centimeter, there is also beauty at a smaller dimension. There are the complicated actions of the cells, and other processes. The fact that the colors in the flower have evolved in order to attract insects to pollinate it is interesting. That means insects can see the colors. That adds a question. Does this aesthetic sense we have also exist in lower forms of life? There are all kinds of interesting questions that come from a knowledge of science, which only adds to the excitement and mystery and awe of a flower. It only adds. I don't understand how it subtracts. I've always been very one-sided about science, and when I was younger, I concentrated almost all my effort on it. In those days, I didn't have time, and I didn't have much patience to learn what's called the humanities. Even though there were humanities courses in the university that you had to take in order to graduate, I tried my best to avoid them. It's only afterwards, when I've gotten older and more relaxed, that I've spread out a little bit. I've learned to draw, and I read a little bit, but I'm really still a very one-sided person, and I don't know a great deal. I have a limited intelligence, and I use it in a particular direction. Before I was born, my father told my mother, "If it's a boy, he's going to be a scientist." Note: Richard's younger sister, Joan, has a Ph.D. in physics, in spite of this preconception that only boys are destined to be scientists. End of note. When I was just a little kid, very small in a high chair, my father brought home a lot of little bathroom tiles, seconds, of different colors. We played with them, my father setting them up vertically on my high chair like dominoes, and I would push one end so they would all go down. Then after a while, I'd help set them up. Pretty soon, we're setting them up in a more complicated way. Two white tiles and a blue tile. Two white tiles and a blue tile, and so on. When my mother saw that, she said, "Leave the poor child alone. If he wants to put a blue tile, let him put a blue tile." But my father said, "No, I want to show him what patterns are like, and how interesting they are. It's a kind of elementary mathematics." So he started very early to tell me about the world and how interesting it is. We had the Encyclopedia Britannica at home. When I was a small boy, he used to sit me on his lap and read to me from the Britannica. We would be reading, say, about dinosaurs. It would be talking about the Tyrannosaurus Rex, and it would say something like, "This dinosaur is 25 feet high, and its head is 6 feet across." My father would stop reading and say, "Now let's see what that means. That would mean that if he stood in our front yard, he would be tall enough to put his head through our window up here." We were on the second floor. "But his head would be too wide to fit in the window." Everything he read to me, he would translate as best he could into some reality. It was very exciting and very, very interesting to think there were animals of such magnitude, and that they all died out, and that nobody knew why. I wasn't frightened that there would be one coming in my window as a consequence of this, but I learned from my father to translate. Everything I read, I try to figure out what it really means, what it's really saying. We used to go to the Catskill Mountains, a place where people from New York City would go in the summer. The fathers would all return to New York to work during the week and come back only for the weekend. On weekends, my father would take me for walks in the woods, and he'd tell me about interesting things that were going on in the woods. When the other mothers saw this, they thought it was wonderful and that the other fathers should take their sons for walks. They tried to work on them, but they didn't get anywhere at first. They wanted my father to take all the kids, but he didn't want to because he had a special relationship with me. So it ended up that the other fathers had to take their children for walks the next weekend. The next Monday, when the fathers were all back at work, we kids were playing in a field. One kid says to me, "See that bird? What kind of bird is that?" I said, "I haven't the slightest idea what kind of bird it is." He says, "It's a brown-throated thrush. Your father doesn't teach you anything." But it was the opposite. He had already taught me. "See that bird?" he says. "It's a Spencer's Warbler." I knew he didn't know the real name. "Well, in Italian, it's a cuto lapetida. In Portuguese, it's a bom da peida. In Chinese, it's a chung long ta. And in Japanese, it's a katano tekida. You can know the name of that bird in all the languages of the world, but when you're finished, you'll know absolutely nothing whatever about the bird. You'll only know about humans in different places and what they call the bird. So let's look at the bird and see what it's doing. That's what counts." I learned very early the difference between knowing the name of something and knowing something. He said, "For example, look. The bird pecks at its feathers all the time. See it walking around, pecking at its feathers?" "Yeah." He says, "Why do you think birds peck at their feathers?" I said, "Well, maybe they mess up their feathers when they fly, so they're pecking them in order to straighten them out." "All right," he says. "If that were the case, then they would peck a lot just after they've been flying. Then after they've been on the ground a while, they wouldn't peck so much anymore. You know what I mean?" "Yeah," he says. "Let's look and see if they peck more just after they land." It wasn't hard to tell. There was not much difference between the birds that had been walking around a bit and those that had just landed. So I said, "I give up. Why does a bird peck at its feathers?" "Because there are lice bothering it," he says. "The lice eat flakes of protein that come off its feathers." He continued, Each louse has some waxy stuff on its legs, and little mites eat that. The mites don't digest it perfectly, so they emit from their rear ends a sugar-like material in which bacteria grow. Finally, he says, so you see, everywhere there's a source of food, there's some form of life that finds it. Now, I knew that it may not have been exactly a louse, that it might not be exactly true that the louse's legs have mites. That story was probably incorrect in detail. But what he was telling me was right, in principle. Another time, when I was older, he picked a leaf off of a tree. This leaf had a flaw, a thing we never look at much. The leaf was sort of deteriorated. It had a little brown line in the shape of a C, starting somewhere in the middle of the leaf and going out in a curl to the edge. "Look at this brown line," he says. "It's narrow at the beginning and it's wider as it goes to the edge. What this is a fly. A blue fly with yellow eyes and green wings has come and laid an egg on this leaf. Then, when the egg hatches into a maggot, a caterpillar-like thing, it spends its whole life eating this leaf. That's where it gets its food. As it eats along, it leaves behind this brown trail of eaten leaf. As the maggot grows, the trail grows wider until he's grown to full size at the end of the leaf, where he turns into a fly, a blue fly with yellow eyes and green wings, who flies away and lays an egg on another leaf." Again, I knew that the details weren't precisely correct. It could have even been a beetle. But the idea that he was trying to explain to me was the amusing part of life. The whole thing is just reproduction. No matter how complicated the business is, the main point is to do it again. Not having experience with many fathers, I didn't realize how remarkable he was. How did he learn the deep principles of science and the love of it, what's behind it, and why it's worth doing? I never really asked him because I just assumed that those were things that fathers knew. My father taught me to notice things. One day I was playing with an express wagon, a little wagon with a railing around it. It had a ball in it, and when I pulled the wagon, I noticed something about the way the ball moved. I went to my father and said, "Say, Pop, I noticed something. When I pull the wagon, the ball rolls to the back of the wagon, and when I'm pulling it along and I suddenly stop, the ball rolls to the front of the wagon. Why is that?" "That nobody knows," he said. "The general principle is that things which are moving tend to keep on moving, and things which are standing still tend to stand still, unless you push them hard. This tendency is called inertia, but nobody knows why it's true." Now that's a deep understanding. He didn't just give me the name. He went on to say, "If you look from the side, you'll see that it's the back of the wagon that you're pulling against the ball, and the ball stands still. As a matter of fact, from the friction it starts to move forward a little bit in relation to the ground. It doesn't move back." I ran back to the little wagon and set the ball up again and pulled the wagon. Looking sideways, I saw that indeed he was right. Relative to the sidewalk, it moved forward a little bit. That's the way I was educated by my father, with those kinds of examples and discussions. No pressure, just lovely, interesting discussions. It has motivated me for the rest of my life, and makes me interested in all the sciences. Just happens I do physics better. I've been caught, so to speak, like someone who was given something wonderful when he was a child, and he's always looking for it again. I'm always looking like a child for the wonders I know I'm going to find. Maybe not every time, but every once in a while. Around that time, my cousin, who was 3 years older, was in high school. He was having considerable difficulty with his algebra, so a tutor would come. I was allowed to sit in a corner while the tutor would try to teach my cousin algebra. I'd hear him talking about X. I said to my cousin, "What are you trying to do?" "I'm trying to find out what X is, like in 2X plus 7 equals 15. I say, "You mean 4? "Yeah, but you did it by arithmetic. You have to do it by algebra." I learned algebra, fortunately, not by going to school, but by finding my aunt's old school book in the attic, and understanding that the whole idea was to find out what X is. It doesn't make any difference how you do it. For me, there was no such thing as doing it by arithmetic or doing it by algebra. Doing it by algebra was a set of rules which, if you followed them blindly, could produce the answer. Subtract 7 from both sides. If you have a multiplier, divide both sides by the multiplier, and so on. A series of steps by which you could get the answer if you didn't understand what you were trying to do. The rules had been invented so that the children who have to study algebra can all pass it. And that's why my cousin was never able to do algebra. There was a series of math books in our local library which started out with Arithmetic for the Practical Man. Then came Algebra for the Practical Man, and then Trigonometry for the Practical Man. I learned trigonometry from that, but I soon forgot it again because I didn't understand it very well. When I was about 13, the library was going to get Calculus for the Practical Man. By this time I knew, from reading the encyclopedia, that calculus was an important and interesting subject, and I ought to learn it. When I finally saw the calculus book at the library, I was very excited. I went to the librarian to check it out, but she looked at me and said, "You're just a child. What are you taking this book out for?" It was one of the few times in my life I was uncomfortable, and I lied. I said it was for my father. I took the book home, and I began to learn calculus from it. I thought it was relatively simple and straightforward. My father started to read it, but he found it confusing, and he couldn't understand it. So I tried to explain calculus to him. I didn't know he was so limited, and it bothered me a little bit. It was the first time I realized that I had learned more in some sense than he. One of the things that my father taught me, besides physics, whether it's correct or not, was a disrespect for certain kinds of things. For example, when I was a little boy, and he would sit me on his knee, he'd show me rotogravures in the New York Times. That's printed pictures which had just come out in newspapers. One time we were looking at a picture of the Pope, and everybody bowing in front of him. My father said, "Now look at those humans. Here's one human standing here, and all these others are bowing in front of him. Now what's the difference? This one is the Pope." He hated the Pope anyway. He said, "This difference is the hat he's wearing." If it was a general, it was the epaulets. It was always the costume, the uniform, the position. "But," he said, "this man has the same problems as everybody else. He eats dinner. He goes to the bathroom. He's a human being." By the way, my father was in the uniform business, so he knew what the difference is in a man with the uniform off and the uniform on. It was the same man for him. He was happy with me, I believe. Once, though, when I came back from MIT, I'd been there a few years, he said to me, "Now that you've become educated about these things, there's one question I've always had that I never understood very well." I asked him what it was. He said, "I understand that when an atom makes a transition from one state to another, it emits a particle of light called a photon." "That's right," I said. He says, "Is the photon in the atom ahead of time?" "No, there's no photon beforehand." "Well," he says, "where does it come from then? How does it come out?" I tried to explain it to him, that photon numbers aren't conserved. They're just created by the motion of the electron. But I couldn't explain it very well. I said, "It's like the sound that I'm making now. It wasn't in me before." It's not like my little boy, who suddenly announced one day, when he was very young, that he could no longer say a certain word. The word turned out to be cat, because his word bag had run out of the word. There's no word bag that makes you use up words as they come out. In the same sense, there's no photon bag in an atom. He was not satisfied with me in that respect. I was never able to explain any of the things that he didn't understand. So he was unsuccessful. He sent me to all these universities in order to find out those things, and he never did find out. Although my mother didn't know anything about science, she had a great influence on me as well. In particular, she had a wonderful sense of humor. And I learned from her that the highest forms of understanding we can achieve are laughter and human compassion. What do you care what other people think? When I was a young fella, about 13, I had somehow gotten in with a group of guys who were a little older than I was and more sophisticated. They knew a lot of different girls and would go out with them, often to the beach. One time, when we were at the beach, most of the guys had gone out on some jetty with the girls. I was interested in a particular girl a little bit, and sort of thought out loud, "Gee, I think I'd like to take Barbara to the movies." That's all I had to say, and the guy next to me gets all excited. He runs out onto the rocks and finds her. He pushes her back, all the while saying in a loud voice, "Feynman has something he wants to say to you, Barbara." It was most embarrassing. Pretty soon the guys are all standing around me saying, "Well, say it, Feynman." So I invited her to the movies. It was my first date. I went home and told my mother about it. She gave me all kinds of advice on how to do this and that. For example, if we take the bus, I'm supposed to get off the bus first and offer Barbara my hand. Or if we have to walk on the street, I'm supposed to walk on the outside. She even told me what kinds of things to say. She was handing down a cultural tradition to me. The women teach their sons how to treat the next generation of women well. After dinner, I get all slicked up and go to Barbara's house to call for her. I'm nervous. She isn't ready, of course. It's always like that. So her family has me wait for her in the dining room, where they're eating with friends, a lot of people. They say things like, "Isn't he cute?" and all kinds of other stuff. I didn't feel cute. It was absolutely terrible. I remember everything about the date. As we walked from her house to the new little theater in town, we talked about playing the piano. I told her how, when I was younger, they made me learn piano for a while, but after 6 months I was still playing Dance of the Daisies and couldn't stand it anymore. You see, I was worried about being a sissy, and to be stuck for weeks playing Dance of the Daisies was too much for me, so I quit. I was so sensitive about being a sissy that it even bothered me when my mother sent me to the market to buy some snacks called peppermint patties and toasted dainties. We saw the movie, and I walked her back to her home. I complimented her on the nice pretty gloves she was wearing. Then I said goodnight to her on the doorstep. Barbara says to me, "Thank you for a very lovely evening." "You're welcome," I answered. I felt terrific. The next time I went out on a date, it was with a different girl. I say goodnight to her, and she says, "Thank you for a very lovely evening." I didn't feel quite so terrific. When I said goodnight to the third girl I took out, she's got her mouth open, ready to speak, and I say, "Thank you for a very lovely evening." She says, "Thank you, I had a lovely evening, too. Thank you." One time I was at a party with my beach crowd, and one of the older guys was in the kitchen teaching us how to kiss, using his girlfriend to demonstrate. You have to have your lips like this, at right angles, so the noses don't collide, and so on. So I go into the living room and find a girl. I'm sitting on the couch with my arm around her, practicing this new art, when suddenly there's all kinds of excitement. "Arlene is coming! Arlene is coming!" I don't know who Arlene is. Then someone says, "She's here! She's here!" And everybody stops what they're doing and jumps up to see this queen. Arlene was very pretty, and I could see why she had all this admiration. It was well deserved. But I didn't believe in this undemocratic business of changing what you're doing just because the queen is coming in. So while everybody's going over to see Arlene, I'm still sitting there on the couch with my girl. Arlene told me later, after I had gotten to know her, that she remembered that party with all the nice people, except for one guy who was over in the corner on the couch, smooching with a girl. What she didn't know was that 2 minutes before, all the others were doing it too. The first time I ever said anything to Arlene was at a dance. She was very popular, and everybody was cutting in and dancing with her. I remember thinking I'd like to dance with her too, and trying to decide when to cut in. I always had trouble with that problem. First of all, when she's over on the other side of the dance floor dancing with some guy, it's too complicated, so you wait until they come closer. Then, when she's near you, you think, "Well, no, this isn't the kind of music I'm good at dancing to." So you wait for another type of music. When the music changes to something you like, you sort of step forward. At least you think you step forward to cut in, when some other guy cuts in just in front of you. So now you have to wait a few minutes, because it's impolite to cut in too soon after someone else has. And by the time a few minutes have passed, they're over at the other side of the dance floor again, or the music has changed again, or whatever. After a certain amount of this stalling and fooling around, I finally mutter something about wanting to dance with Arlene. One of the guys I was hanging around with overhears me and makes a big announcement to the other guys. "Hey, listen to this, guys. Feynman wants to dance with Arlene." Soon, one of them is dancing with Arlene, and they dance over towards the rest of us. The others push me out onto the dance floor, and I finally cut in. You can see the condition I was in by my first words to her, which were an honest question. "How does it feel to be so popular?" We only danced a few minutes before somebody else cut in. My friends and I had taken dancing lessons, although none of us would ever admit it. In those Depression days, a friend of my mother was trying to make a living by teaching dancing in the evening, in an upstairs dance studio. There was a back door to the place, and she arranged it so the young men could come up through the back way without being seen. Every once in a while, there would be a social dance at this lady's studio. I didn't have the nerve to test this analysis, but it seemed to me that the girls had a much harder time than the boys did. In those days, girls couldn't ask to cut in and dance with boys. It wasn't proper. So the girls who weren't very pretty would sit for hours at the side, just sad as hell. I thought, The guys have it easy. They're free to cut in whenever they want. But it wasn't easy. You're free, but you haven't got the guts or the sense or whatever it takes to relax and enjoy dancing. Instead, you tie yourself in knots worrying about cutting in or inviting a girl to dance with you. For example, if you saw a girl who was not dancing, who you thought you'd like to dance with, you might think, "Good, now at least I've got a chance." But it was usually very difficult. Often the girl would say, "No, thank you, I'm tired. I think I'll sit this one out." So you go away somewhat defeated, but not completely, because maybe she really is tired, when you turn around and some other guy comes up to her, and there she is dancing with him. Maybe this guy is her boyfriend, and she knew he was coming over, or maybe she didn't like the way you look, or maybe something else. It was always so complicated for such a simple matter. One time I decided to invite Arlene to one of these dances. It was the first time I took her out. My best friends were also at the dance. My mother had invited them to get more customers for her friend's dance studio. These guys were contemporaries of mine, guys my own age from school. Harold Gast and David Leff were literary types, while Robert Stapler was a scientific type. We would spend a lot of time together after school going on walks and discussing this and that. Anyway, my best friends were at the dance, and as soon as they saw me with Arlene, they called me into the cloakroom and said, "Now listen, Feynman, we want you to understand that we understand that Arlene is your girl tonight, and we're not going to bother you with her. She's out of bounds for us," and so on. But before long, there was cutting in and competition coming from precisely these guys. I learned the meaning of Shakespeare's phrase, "Methinks thou dost protest too much." You must appreciate what I was like then. I was a very shy character, always feeling uncomfortable because everybody was stronger than I, and always afraid I would look like a sissy. Everybody else played baseball. Everybody else did all kinds of athletic things. If there was a game somewhere and a ball would come rolling across the road, I would be petrified that maybe I'd have to pick it up and throw it back, because if I threw it, it would be about a radian off the correct direction and not anywhere near the distance. And then everybody would laugh. It was terrible, and I was very unhappy about it. One time I was invited to a party at Arlene's house. Everybody was there because Arlene was the most popular girl around. She was number one, the nicest girl, and everybody liked her. Well, I'm sitting in a big armchair with nothing to do, when Arlene comes over and sits on the arm of the chair to talk to me. That was the beginning of the feeling, "Oh boy, the world is just wonderful now. Somebody I like has paid attention to me." In those days, in Far Rockaway, there was a youth center for Jewish kids at the temple. It was a big club that had many activities. There was a writer's group that wrote stories and would read them to each other. There was a drama group that put on plays. There was a science group and an art group. I had no interest in any subject except science, but Arlene was in the art group, so I joined it too. I struggled with the art business, learning how to make plaster casts of the face and so on, which I used much later in life, it turned out, just so I could be in the same group with Arlene. But Arlene had a boyfriend named Jerome in the group, so there was no chance for me. I just hovered around in the background. One time, when I wasn't there, somebody nominated me for president of the youth center. The elders began getting nervous, because I was an avowed atheist by that time. I had been brought up in the Jewish religion. My family went to the temple every Friday. I was sent to what we called Sunday school, and I even studied Hebrew for a while. But at the same time, my father was telling me about the world. When I would hear the rabbi tell about some miracle, such as a bush whose leaves were shaking but there wasn't any wind, I would try to fit the miracle into the real world and explain it in terms of natural phenomena. Some miracles were harder than others to understand. The one about the leaves was easy. When I was walking to school, I heard a little noise. Although the wind was hardly noticeable, the leaves of a bush were wiggling a little bit because they were in just the right position to make a kind of resonance. And I thought, aha, this is a good explanation for Elijah's vision of the quaking bush. But there were some miracles I never did figure out. For instance, there was a story in which Moses throws down his staff and it turns into a snake. I couldn't figure out what the witness saw that made them think his staff was a snake. If I had thought back to when I was much younger, the Santa Claus story could have provided a clue for me. But it didn't hit me hard enough at the time to produce the possibility that I should doubt the truth of stories that don't fit with nature. When I found out that Santa Claus wasn't real, I wasn't upset. Rather, I was relieved that there was a much simpler phenomenon to explain how so many children all over the world got presents on the same night. The story had been getting pretty complicated. It was getting out of hand. Santa Claus was a particular custom we celebrated in our family, and it wasn't very serious. But the miracles I was hearing about were connected with real things. There was the temple, where people would go every week. There was the Sunday school, where rabbis taught children about miracles. It was much more of a dramatic thing. Santa Claus didn't involve big institutions like the temple, which I knew were real. So all the time I was going to the Sunday school, I was believing everything and having trouble putting it together. But of course, ultimately, it had to come to a crisis, sooner or later. The actual crisis came when I was 11 or 12. The rabbi was telling us a story about the Spanish Inquisition, in which the Jews suffered terrible tortures. He told us about a particular individual whose name was Ruth. Exactly what she was supposed to have done, what the arguments were in her favor and against her, the whole thing, as if it had been all documented by a court reporter. And I was just an innocent kid, listening to all this stuff and believing it was a true commentary, because the rabbi had never indicated otherwise. At the end, the rabbi described how Ruth was dying in prison, and she thought, while she was dying, blah, blah, blah. That was a shock to me. After the lesson was over, I went up to him and said, "How did they know what she thought when she was dying?" He says, "Well, of course, in order to explain more vividly how the Jews suffered, we made up the story of Ruth. It wasn't a real individual." That was too much for me. I felt terribly deceived. I wanted the straight story, not fixed up by somebody else, so I could decide for myself what it meant. But it was difficult for me to argue with adults. All I could do was get tears in my eyes. I started to cry. I was so upset. He said, "What's the matter?" I tried to explain. "I've been listening to all these stories, and now I don't know, of all the things you told me, which were true and which were not true. I don't know what to do with everything that I've learned." I was trying to explain that I was losing everything at the moment, because I was no longer sure of the data, so to speak. Here I had been struggling to understand all these miracles, and now, well, it solved a lot of miracles, all right, but I was unhappy. The rabbi said, "If it is so traumatic for you, why do you come to Sunday school?" "Because my parents make me." I never talked to my parents about it, and I never found out whether the rabbi communicated with them or not. But my parents never made me go again, and it was just before I was supposed to get confirmed as a believer. Anyway, that crisis resolved my difficulty rather rapidly, in favor of the theory that all the miracles were stories made up to help people understand things more vividly, even if they conflicted with natural phenomena. But I thought nature itself was so interesting that I didn't want it distorted like that, and so I gradually came to disbelieve the whole religion. Anyway, the Jewish elders had organized this club with all its activities, not just to get us kids off the street, but to get us interested in the Jewish way of life. So to have someone like me elected as president would have made them very embarrassed. To our mutual relief, I wasn't elected, but the center eventually failed anyway. It was on its way out when I was nominated, and had I been elected, I surely would have been blamed for its demise. One day Arlene told me Jerome isn't her boyfriend anymore. She's not tied up with him. That was a big excitement for me, the beginning of hope. She invited me over to her house at 154 Westminster Avenue in nearby Cedarhurst. When I went to her house that time, it was dark and the porch wasn't lit. I couldn't see the numbers. Not wanting to disturb anyone by asking if it was the right house, I crawled up quietly and felt the numbers on the door. 154. Arlene was having trouble with her homework in philosophy class. "We're studying Descartes," she said. "He starts out with, 'Cogito ergo sum,' 'I think, therefore I am,' and ends up proving the existence of God." "Impossible," I said, without stopping to think that I was doubting the great Descartes. It was a reaction I learned from my father. Have no respect whatsoever for authority. Forget who said it, and instead look at what he starts with, where he ends up, and ask yourself, is it reasonable? I said, "How can you deduce one from the other?" "I don't know," she said. "Well, let's look it over," I said. "What's the argument?" So we look it over, and we see that Descartes' statement, cogito ergo sum, is supposed to mean that there is one thing that cannot be doubted, doubt itself. Why doesn't he just say it straight? I complained. He just means somehow or other that he has one fact that he knows. Then it goes on and says things like, I can only imagine imperfect thoughts, but imperfect can only be understood as referent to the perfect. Hence, the perfect must exist somewhere. He's working his way towards God now. Not at all, I say. In science, you can talk about relative degrees of approximation without having a perfect theory. I don't know what this is all about. I think it's a bunch of baloney. Arlene understood me. She understood, when she looked at it, that no matter how impressive and important this philosophy stuff was supposed to be, it could be taken lightly. You could just think about the words instead of worrying about the fact that Descartes said it. Well, I guess it's okay to take the other side, she said. My teacher keeps telling us there are two sides to every question, just like there are two sides to every piece of paper. There's two sides to that, too, I said. What do you mean? I had read about the Möbius strip in the Britannica, my wonderful Britannica. In those days, things like the Möbius strip weren't so well known to everybody, but they were just as understandable as they are to kids today. The existence of such a surface was so real. It wasn't a wishy-washy political question or anything that you needed history to understand. Reading about those things was like being way off in a wonderful world that nobody knows about. And you're getting a kick not only from the delight of learning the stuff itself, but also from making yourself unique. I got a strip of paper, put a half twist in it, and made it into a loop. Arlene was delighted. The next day in class, she lay in wait for her teacher. Sure enough, he holds up a piece of paper and says, "There are two sides to every question, just like there are two sides to every piece of paper." Arlene holds up her own strip of paper with a half twist in it and says, "Sir, there are even two sides to that question. There's paper with only one side." The teacher and the class got all excited, and Arlene got such a kick out of showing them the Möbius strip that I think she paid more attention to me after that on account of it. But after Jerome, I had a new competitor, my good friend Harold Gast. Arlene was always making up her mind one way or the other. When it came time for graduation, she went with Harold to the senior prom, but sat with my parents for the graduation ceremony. I was the best in science, the best in mathematics, the best in physics, and the best in chemistry. So I was going up to the stage and receiving honors many times at the ceremony. Harold was the best in English and the best in history, and had written a school play, so that was very impressive. I was terrible in English. I couldn't stand the subject. It seemed to me ridiculous to worry about whether you spelled something wrong or not, because English spelling is just a human convention. It has nothing to do with anything real, anything from nature. Any word can be spelled just as well a different way. I was impatient with all this English stuff. There was a series of exams called the Regents, which the state of New York gave to every high school student. A few months before, when we were all taking the Regents examination in English, Harold and the other literary friend of mine, David Leff, the editor of the school newspaper, asked me which books I had chosen to write about. David had chosen something with profound social implications by Sinclair Lewis, and Harold had picked some playwright. I said I chose Treasure Island because we had that book in first-year English, and told them what I wrote. They laughed. "Boy, are you gonna flunk, saying such simple stuff about such a simple book!" There was also a list of questions for an essay. The one I chose was, "The Importance of Science in Aviation." I thought, what a dumb question. The importance of science in aviation is obvious. I was about to write a simple theme about this dumb question when I remembered that my literary friends were always throwing the bull, building up their sentences to sound complex and sophisticated. I decided to try it, just for the hell of it. I thought, if the Regents are so silly as to have a subject like the importance of science in aviation, I'm going to do that. So I wrote stuff like, "Aeronautical science is important in the analysis of the eddies, vortices, and whirlpools formed in the atmosphere behind the aircraft." I knew that eddies, vortices, and whirlpools are the same thing, but mentioning them three different ways sounds better. That was the only thing I would not have ordinarily done on the test. The teacher who corrected my examination must have been impressed by eddies, vortices, and whirlpools, because I got a 91 on the exam, while my literary friends, who chose topics the English teachers could more easily take issue with, both got 88. That year, a new rule came out. If you got 90 or better on a region's examination, you automatically got honors in that subject at graduation. So while the playwright and the editor of the school newspaper had to stay in their seats, this illiterate fool physics student was called to go up to the stage once again and receive honors in English. After the graduation ceremony, Arlene was in the hall with my parents and Harold's parents when the head of the math department came over. He was a very strong man. He was also the school disciplinarian, a tall, dominating fellow. Mrs. Gast says to him, "Hello, Dr. Augsbury. I'm Harold Gast's mother, and this is Mrs. Feynman." He completely ignores Mrs. Gast and immediately turns to my mother. "Mrs. Feynman, I want to impress upon you that a young man like your son comes along only very rarely. The state should support a man of such talent. You must be sure that he goes to college, the best college you can afford." He was concerned that my parents might not be planning to send me to college, for in those days lots of kids had to get a job immediately after graduation to help support the family. That, in fact, happened to my friend Robert. He had a lab, too, and taught me all about lenses and optics. One day, he had an accident in his lab. He was opening carbolic acid and the bottle jerked, spilling some acid on his face. He went to the doctor and had bandages put on for a few weeks. The funny thing was, when they took the bandages off, his skin was smooth underneath, nicer than it had been before. There were many fewer blemishes. I've since found out that there was, for a while, some kind of a beauty treatment using carbolic acid in a more dilute form. Robert's mother was poor, and he had to go to work right away to support her, so he couldn't continue his interest in the sciences. Anyway, my mother reassured Dr. Augsbury, "We're saving money as best we can, and we're trying to send him to Columbia or MIT. And Arlene was listening to all this, so after that I was a little bit ahead. Arlene was a wonderful girl. She was the editor of the newspaper at Nassau County Lawrence High School. She played the piano beautifully and was very artistic. She made some decorations for our house, like the parrot on the inside of our closet. As time went on and our family got to know her better, she would go to the woods to paint with my father, who had taken up painting in later life, as many people do. Arlene and I began to mold each other's personality. She lived in a family that was very polite and was very sensitive to other people's feelings. She taught me to be more sensitive to those kinds of things, too. On the other hand, her family felt that white lies were okay. I thought one should have the attitude of, 'What do you care what other people think?' I said, 'We should listen to other people's opinions and take them into account. Then, if they don't make sense and we think they're wrong, then that's that.' Arlene caught on to the idea right away. It was easy to talk her into thinking that in our relationship we must be very honest with each other and say everything straight, with absolute frankness. It worked very well, and we became very much in love, a love like no other love that I know of. After that summer, I went away to college at MIT. I couldn't go to Columbia because of the Jewish quota. Note for foreign readers. The quota system was a discriminatory practice of limiting the number of places in a university available to students of Jewish background. End of note. I began getting letters from my friends that said things like, "You should see how Arlene is going out with Harold," or, "She's doing this and she's doing that while you're all alone up there in Boston." Well, I was taking out girls in Boston, but they didn't mean a thing to me, and I knew the same was true with Arlene. When summer came, I stayed in Boston for a summer job and worked on measuring friction. The Chrysler Company had developed a new method of polishing to get a super finish, and we were supposed to measure how much better it was. It turned out that the super finish was not significantly better. Anyway, Arlene found a way to be near me. She found a summer job in Scituate, about 20 miles away, taking care of children. But my father was concerned that I would become too involved with Arlene and get off the track of my studies, so he talked her out of it, or talked me out of it. I can't remember. Those days were very, very different from now. In those days, you had to go all the way up in your career before marrying. I was able to see Arlene only a few times that summer, but we promised each other we would marry after I finished school. I had known her for 6 years by that time. I'm a little tongue-tied, trying to describe to you how much our love for each other developed. But we were sure we were right for each other. After I graduated from MIT, I went to Princeton, and I would go home on vacations to see Arlene. One time, when I went to see her, Arlene had developed a bump on one side of her neck. She was a very beautiful girl, so it worried her a little bit, but it didn't hurt, so she figured it wasn't too serious. She went to her uncle, who was a doctor. He told her to rub it with omega oil. Then, sometime later, the bump began to change. It got bigger, or maybe it was smaller, and she got a fever. The fever got worse, so the family doctor decided Arlene should go to the hospital. She was told she had typhoid fever. Right away, as I still do today, I looked up the disease in medical books and read all about it. When I went to see Arlene in the hospital, she was in quarantine. We had to put on special gowns when we entered her room and so on. The doctor was there, so I asked him how the Weidel test came out. It was an absolute test for typhoid fever that involved checking for bacteria in the feces. He said, it was negative. What? How can that be? I said. Why all these gowns when you can't even find the bacteria in an experiment? Maybe she doesn't have typhoid fever. The result of that was that the doctor talked to Arlene's parents, who told me not to interfere. After all, he's the doctor. You're only her fiancé. I found out since that such people don't know what they're doing, and get insulted when you make some suggestion or criticism. I realize that now, but I wish I had been much stronger then and told her parents that the doctor was an idiot, which he was, and didn't know what he was doing. But as it was, her parents were in charge of it. Anyway, after a little while, Arlene got better, apparently. The swelling went down and the fever went away. But after some weeks, the swelling started again, and this time she went to another doctor. This guy feels under her armpits and in her groin and so on, and notices there's a swelling in those places too. He says the problem is in her lymphatic glands, but he doesn't yet know what the specific disease is. He will consult with other doctors. As soon as I hear about it, I go down to the library at Princeton and look up lymphatic diseases and find swelling of the lymphatic glands. 1. Tuberculosis of the lymphatic glands. This is very easy to diagnose. So I figured this isn't what Arlene has, because the doctors are having trouble trying to figure it out. I start reading about some other diseases. Lymphadenema, lymphadenoma, Hodgkin's disease, all kinds of other things. They're all cancers of one crazy form or another. The only difference between lymphadenema and lymphadenoma was, as far as I could make out by reading it very carefully, that if the patient dies, it's lymphadenoma. If the patient survives, at least for a while, then it's lymphadenema. At any rate, I read through all the lymphatic diseases and decided that the most likely possibility was that Arlene had an incurable disease. Then I half smiled to myself, thinking, I bet everybody who reads through a medical book thinks they have a fatal disease. And yet, after reading everything very carefully, I couldn't find any other possibility. It was serious. Then I went to the weekly tea at Palmer Hall and found myself talking to the mathematicians just as I always did, even though I had just found out that Arlene probably had a fatal disease. It was very strange, like having two minds. When I went to visit her, I told Arlene the joke about the people who don't know any medicine, reading the medical book and always assuming they have a fatal disease. But I also told her I thought we were in great difficulty, and that the best I could figure out was that she had an incurable disease. We discussed the various diseases, and I told her what each one was like. One of the diseases I told Arlene about was Hodgkin's disease. When she next saw her doctor, she asked him about it. Could it be Hodgkin's disease? He said, well, yes, that's a possibility. When she went to the county hospital, the doctor wrote the following diagnosis. Hodgkin's disease? Question mark. So I realized that the doctor didn't know any more than I did about this problem. The county hospital gave Arlene all sorts of tests and x-ray treatments for this Hodgkin's disease, question mark, and there were special meetings to discuss this peculiar case. I remember waiting for her outside in the hall. When the meeting was over, the nurse wheeled her out in a wheelchair. All of a sudden, a little guy comes running out of the meeting room and catches up with us. Tell me, he says, out of breath, do you spit up blood? Have you ever coughed up blood? The nurse says, go away, go away. What kind of thing is that to ask of a patient? And brushes him away. Then she turned to us and said, That man is a doctor from the neighborhood who comes to the meeting and is always making trouble. That's not the kind of thing to ask of a patient. I didn't catch on. The doctor was checking a certain possibility, and if I had been smart, I would have asked him what it was. Finally, after a lot of discussion, a doctor at the hospital tells me they figure the most likely possibility is Hodgkin's disease. He says, "There will be some periods of improvement and some periods in the hospital. It will be on and off, getting gradually worse. There's no way to reverse it entirely. It's fatal after a few years." "I'm sorry to hear that," I say. "I'll tell her what you said." "No, no," says the doctor. "We don't want to upset the patient. We're going to tell her it's glandular fever." "No, no," I reply. "We've already discussed the possibility of Hodgkin's disease. I know she can adjust to it. Her parents don't want her to know. You had better talk to them first." At home, everybody worked on me. My parents, my two aunts, our family doctor. They were all on me, saying I'm a very foolish young man who doesn't realize what pain he's going to bring to this wonderful girl by telling her she has a fatal disease. "How can you do such a terrible thing?" they asked in horror. "Because we have made a pact that we must speak honestly with each other and look at everything directly. There's no use fooling around. She's going to ask me what she's got, and I cannot lie to her." "Oh, that's childish," they said. "Blah, blah, blah." Everybody kept working on me and said I was wrong. I thought I was definitely right, because I had already talked to Arlene about the disease and knew she could face it, that telling her the truth was the right way to handle it. But finally my little sister comes up to me. She was 11 or 12 then, with tears running down her face. She beats me on the chest, telling me that Arlene is such a wonderful girl, and that I'm such a foolish, stubborn brother. I couldn't take it anymore. That broke me down. So I wrote Arlene a goodbye love letter, figuring that if she ever found out the truth after I had told her it was glandular fever, we would be through. I carried the letter with me all the time. The gods never made it easy. They always make it harder. I go to the hospital to see Arlene, having made this decision, and there she is, sitting up in bed, surrounded by her parents, somewhat distraught. When she sees me, her face lights up, and she says, "Now I know how valuable it is that we tell each other the truth." Nodding at her parents, she continues, "They're telling me I have glandular fever, and I'm not sure whether I believe them or not. Tell me, Richard, do I have Hodgkin's disease or glandular fever?" "You have glandular fever," I said, and I died inside. It was terrible, just terrible. Her reaction was completely simple. "Oh, fine, then I believe them." Because we had built up so much trust in each other, she was completely relieved. Everything was solved, and all was very nice. She got a little bit better and went home for a while. About a week later, I get a telephone call. "Richard," she says, "I want to talk to you. Come on over." "Okay." I made sure I still had the letter with me. I could tell something was the matter. I go upstairs to her room, and she says, "Sit down." I sit down on the end of her bed. "All right, now tell me," she says. "Do I have glandular fever or Hodgkin's disease?" "You have Hodgkin's disease," and I reach for the letter. "God," she says, "they must have put you through hell." I had just told her she has a fatal disease, and was admitting that I had lied to her as well, and what does she think of? She's worried about me. I was terribly ashamed of myself. I gave Arlene the letter. "You should have stuck by it. We know what we're doing. We are right." "I'm sorry. I feel awful." "I understand, Richard. Just don't do it again." You see, she was in bed upstairs and did something she used to do when she was little. She tiptoed out of bed and crawled down the stairs a little bit to listen to what people were doing downstairs. She heard her mother crying a lot and went back to bed thinking, "If I have glandular fever, why is mother crying so much? But Richard said I had glandular fever, so it must be right." Later she thought, "Could Richard have lied to me?" and began to wonder how that might be possible. She concluded that, incredible as it sounded, somebody might have put me through a ringer of some sort. She was so good at facing difficult situations that she went on to the next problem. "Okay," she says, "I have Hodgkin's disease. What are we going to do now?" "I had a scholarship at Princeton, and they wouldn't let me keep it if I got married. We knew what the disease was like. Sometimes it would get better for some months, and Arlene could be at home, and then she would have to be in the hospital for some months, back and forth for 2 years, perhaps. So I figure, although I'm in the middle of trying to get my Ph.D., I could get a job at the Bell Telephone Laboratories doing research. It was a very good place to work. and we could get a little apartment in Queens that wasn't too far from the hospital or Bell Labs. We could get married in a few months in New York. We worked everything out that afternoon. For some months now, Arlene's doctors had wanted to take a biopsy of the swelling on her neck, but her parents didn't want it done. They didn't want to bother the poor sick girl. But with new resolve, I kept working on them, explaining that it's important to get as much information as possible. With Arlene's help, I finally convinced her parents. A few days later, Arlene telephones me and says, "They got a report from the biopsy." "Yeah? Is it good or bad?" "I don't know. Come over and let's talk about it." When I got to her house, she showed me the report. It said, "Biopsy shows tuberculosis of the lymphatic gland." That really got me. I mean, that was the first goddamn thing on the list. I passed it by because the book said it was easy to diagnose, and because the doctors were having so much trouble trying to figure out what it was. I assumed they had checked the obvious case, and it was the obvious case. The man who had come running out of the meeting room asking, "Do you spit up blood?" had the right idea. He knew what it probably was. I felt like a jerk, because I had passed over the obvious possibility by using circumstantial evidence, which isn't any good, and by assuming the doctors were more intelligent than they were. Otherwise, I would have suggested it right off, and perhaps the doctor would have diagnosed Arlene's disease way back then as tuberculosis of the lymphatic gland, question mark? I was a dope. I've learned since then. Anyway, Arlene says, "So I might live as long as 7 years. I may even get better." "So what do you mean you don't know if it's good or bad?" "Well, now we won't be able to get married until later." Knowing that she had only 2 more years to live, we had solved things so perfectly from her point of view that she was disturbed to discover she'd live longer. But it didn't take me long to convince her it was a better circumstance. So we knew we could face things together from then on. After going through that, we had no difficulty facing any other problem. When the war came, I was recruited to work on the Manhattan Project at Princeton, where I was finishing up my degree. A few months later, as soon as I got my degree, I announced to my family that I wanted to get married. My father was horrified, because from the earliest times, as he saw me develop, he thought I would be happy as a scientist. He thought it was still too early to marry. It would interfere with my career. He also had this crazy idea. If a guy was in some difficulty, he used to always say, "Cherchez la femme." Look for the woman behind it. He felt that women were the great danger to a man, that a man always has to watch out and be tough about women. And when he sees me marrying a girl with tuberculosis, he thinks of the possibility that I'm going to get sick too. My whole family was worried about that. Aunts, uncles, everyone. They brought the family doctor over to our house. He tried to explain to me that tuberculosis is a dangerous disease, and that I'm bound to get it. I said, "Just tell me how it's transmitted, and we'll figure it out." We were already very, very careful. We knew we must not kiss, because there's a lot of bacteria in the mouth. Then they very carefully explained to me that when I had promised to marry Arlene, I didn't know the situation. Everybody would understand that I didn't know the situation then, and that it didn't represent a real promise. I never had that feeling, that crazy idea that they had, that I was getting married because I had promised it. I hadn't even thought of that. It wasn't a question of having promised anything. We had stalled around, not getting a piece of paper, and not formally married, but we were in love, and were already married emotionally. I said, "Would it be sensible for a husband who learns that his wife has tuberculosis to leave her?" Only my aunt, who ran the hotel, thought maybe it would be all right for us to get married. Everybody else was still against it. But this time, since my family had given me this kind of advice before, and it had been so wrong, I was in a much stronger position. It was very easy to resist and to just proceed. So there was no problem, really. Although it was a similar circumstance, they weren't going to convince me of anything anymore. Arlene and I knew we were right in what we were doing. Arlene and I worked everything out. There was a hospital in New Jersey, just south of Fort Dix, where she could stay while I was at Princeton. It was a charity hospital. Deborah was the name of it, supported by the Women's Garment Workers Union of New York. Arlene wasn't a garment worker, but it didn't make any difference. And I was just a young fellow working on this project for the government, and the pay was very low. But this way I could take care of her at last. We decided to get married on the way to Deborah Hospital. I went to Princeton to pick up a car, Bill Woodward, one of the graduate students there, lent me his station wagon. I fixed it up like a little ambulance, with a mattress and sheets in the back, so Arlene could lie down in case she got tired. Although this was one of the periods when the disease was apparently not so bad and she was at home, Arlene had been in the county hospital a lot, and she was a little weak. I drove up to Cedarhurst and picked up my bride. Arlene's family waved goodbye, and off we went. We crossed Queens and Brooklyn, then went to Staten Island on the ferry. That was our romantic boat ride, and drove to the City Hall for the borough of Richmond to get married. We went up the stairs slowly into the office. The guy there was very nice. He did everything right away. He said, "You don't have any witnesses." So we called the bookkeeper and an accountant from another room, and we were married according to the laws of the state of New York. Then we were very happy, and we smiled at each other, holding hands. The bookkeeper says to me, "You're married now. You should kiss the bride." So the bashful character kissed his bride lightly on the cheek. I gave everyone a tip, and we thanked them very much. We got back in the car and drove to Deborah Hospital. Every weekend I'd go down from Princeton to visit Arlene. One time the bus was late and I couldn't get into the hospital. There weren't any hotels nearby, but I had my old sheepskin coat on, so I was warm enough, and I looked for an empty lot to sleep in. I was a little worried what it might look like in the morning when people looked out of their windows, so I found a place that was far enough away from houses. The next morning I woke up and discovered I'd been sleeping in a garbage dump, a landfill. I felt foolish and laughed. Arlene's doctor was very nice, but he would get upset when I brought in a war bond for $18 every month. He could see we didn't have much money, and kept insisting we shouldn't contribute to the hospital, but I did it anyway. One time at Princeton, I received a box of pencils in the mail. They were dark green, and in gold letters were the words, "Richard, darling, I love you. Putsy." It was Arlene. I called her Putsy. Well, that was nice, and I love her too. But you know how you absent-mindedly drop pencils around. You're showing Professor Wigner a formula or something, and leave the pencil on his desk. In those days, we didn't have extra stuff, so I didn't want to waste the pencils. I got a razor blade from the bathroom and cut off the writing on one of them to see if I could use them. The next morning, I get a letter in the mail. It starts out, "What's the idea of trying to cut the name off the pencils?" It continues, "Aren't you proud of the fact that I love you?" Then, "What do you care what other people think?" Then came poetry. "If you're ashamed of me, da, da, then pecans to you, pecans to you." The next verse was the same kind of stuff, with the last line, "Almonds to you, almonds to you." Each one was nuts to you in a different form. So I had to use the pencils with the names on them. What else could I do? It wasn't long before I had to go to Los Alamos. Robert Oppenheimer, who was in charge of the project, arranged for Arlene to stay in the nearest hospital in Albuquerque, about 100 miles away. I had time off every weekend to see her. So I would hitchhike down on a Saturday, see Arlene in the afternoon, and stay overnight in a hotel there in Albuquerque. Then, on Sunday morning, I would see Arlene again and hitchhike back to Los Alamos in the afternoon. During the week, I would often get letters from her. Some of them, like the one written on a jigsaw puzzle blank, and then taken apart and sent in a sack, resulted in little notes from the Army censor, such as, "Please tell your wife we don't have time to play games around here." I didn't tell her anything. I liked her to play games, even though she often put me in various uncomfortable but amusing conditions from which I could not escape. One time, near the beginning of May, newspapers mysteriously appeared in almost everybody's mailbox at Los Alamos. The whole damn place was full of them, hundreds of newspapers. You know the kind. You open it up and there's this headline screaming in thick letters across the front page. "Entire Nation Celebrates Birthday of R.P. Feynman." Arlene was playing her game with the world. She had a lot of time to think. She would read magazines and send away for this and that. She was always cooking up something. She must have got help with the names from Nick Metropolis or one of the other guys at Los Alamos who would often visit her. Arlene was in her room, but she was in the world, writing me crazy letters and sending away for all kinds of stuff. One time she sent me a big catalog of kitchen equipment, the kind you need for enormous institutions like prisons, which have a lot of people in them, It showed everything from blowers and hoods for stoves to huge pots and pans. So I'm thinking, what the hell is this? It reminded me of the time I was up at MIT, and Arlene sent me a catalog describing huge boats from warships to ocean liners. Great big boats. I wrote to her, what's the idea? She writes back, I just thought that maybe, when we get married, we could buy a boat. I write, are you crazy? It's all out of proportion. Then another catalog comes. It's for big yachts, 40-foot schooners and stuff like that, for very rich people. She writes, since you said no to the other boats, maybe we could get one of these. I write, look, you're way out of scale. Soon another catalog comes. It's for various kinds of motorboats, Christcraft this and that. I write, too expensive. Finally, I get a note. This is your last chance, Richard. You're always saying no. It turns out a friend of hers has a rowboat she wants to sell for $15, a used rowboat, and maybe we could buy it so we could row around in the water next summer. So yes, I mean, how can you say no after all that? Well, I'm still trying to figure out what this big catalog for institutional kitchen equipment is leading to, when another catalog comes. It's for hotels and restaurants, supplies for small and medium-sized hotels and restaurants. Then a few days later, a catalog for the kitchen in your new home comes. When I go down to Albuquerque the next Saturday, I find out what it's all about. There's a little charcoal broiler in her room. She's bought it through the mail from Sears. It's about 18 inches across with little legs. I thought we could have steaks, Arlene says. How the hell can we use it in the room here with all the smoke and everything? Oh, no, she says. All you have to do is take it out on the lawn. Then you can cook us steaks every Sunday. The hospital was right on Route 66, the main road across the United States. I can't do that, I said. I mean, with all the cars and trucks going by, all the people on the sidewalk walking back and forth, I can't just go out there and start cooking steaks on the lawn. What do you care what other people think? Arlene tortured me with that. Okay, she says, opening a drawer. We'll compromise. You don't have to wear the chef's hat and the gloves. She holds up a hat. It's a real chef's hat and gloves. Then she says, try on the apron, as she unfolds it. It has something silly written across it, like Barbecue King or something. Okay, okay, I say horrified. I'll cook the steaks on the lawn. So every Saturday or Sunday, I go out there on Route 66 and cook steaks. Then there were the Christmas cards. One day, only a few weeks after I had arrived at Los Alamos, Arlene says, I thought it would be nice to send Christmas cards to everybody. Would you like to see the ones I picked out? They were nice cards, all right, but inside they said Merry Christmas from Rich and Putsy. I can't send these to Fermi and Beta, I protested. I hardly even know them. What do you care what other people think? Naturally. So we sent them. Next year comes around, and by this time I know Fermi. I know Beta. I've been over at their houses. I've taken care of their kids. We're all very friendly. Somewhere along the line, Arlene says to me in a very formal tone, "You haven't asked me about our Christmas cards this year, Richard." Fear goes through me. Well, let's see the cards. The cards say Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from Richard and Arlene Feynman. Well, that's fine, I say. They're very nice. They'll go fine for everybody. Oh, no, she says. They won't do for Fermi and Beta and all those other famous people. Sure enough, she's got another box of cards. She pulls one out. It says the usual stuff, and then, from Dr. and Mrs. R. P. Feynman. So I had to send them those. What's this formal stuff, Dick? They laughed. They were happy that she was having such a good time out of it, and that I had no control over it. Arlene didn't spend all of her time inventing games. She had sent away for a book called Sound and Symbol in Chinese. It was a lovely book. I still have it, with about 50 symbols done in beautiful calligraphy, with explanations like Trouble, Three Women in a House. She had the right paper, brushes, and ink, and was practicing calligraphy. She had also bought a Chinese dictionary to get a lot of other symbols. One time, when I came to visit her, Arlene was practicing these things. She says to herself, no, that one's wrong. So I, the great scientist, say, what do you mean, wrong? It's only a human convention. There's no law of nature which says how they're supposed to look. You can draw them any way you want. I mean, artistically, it's wrong. It's a question of balance, of how it feels. But one way is just as good as another, I protest. Here, she says, and she hands me the brush. Make one yourself. So I made one, and I said, wait a minute. Let me make another one. It's too blobby. I couldn't say it was wrong, after all. How do you know how blobby it's supposed to be? She says. I learned what she meant. There's a particular way you have to make the stroke for it to look good. An aesthetic thing has a certain set, a certain character, which I can't define. Because it couldn't be defined made me think there was nothing to it. But I learned from that experience that there is something to it. And it's a fascination I've had for art ever since.